jam. Got me running round in circles, grinning upside down. The 7 AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chips Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Ken B. Really doesn't need an introduction. I think he's had a big impact on most of the people's sobriety that are with us tonight. And if he hasn't, I'm sure he will. So I give you Ken B.
Thanks, Tim. And thanks for having me and everybody who read. And I want to introduce you all to my new friend, Sabrina, who came to the meeting that I do on Mondays and Thursdays, which is my home group, called the INAMI meeting, which means it's not about me. And so, Sabrina, all these ladies in this meeting have been sober a long time, and I'm sure they'll send you their phone numbers. And several of them come to that Saturday-Sunday meeting I was telling you about. So connect with these ladies. They're good folk. And they'll do you right with staying sober. In case I forgot to say it, my name's Ken. I'm an alcoholic. For me, my story's kind of boring because I lived it. And I've been sober for a long time. My sobriety date is July 11th, 1986. So most of, I guess, the majority of my adult life or of my whole life, since I'm only 52, has been sober. And I've done most of my living in AA. I got sober when I was 18. I came to AA the first time when I was, well, actually, the first time I came to AA was when I was 13, and I had gotten sentenced to some treatment center for a bunch of felonies, which I was falsely accused of, and by the man who was always trying to keep me down. And so the treatment center did the best they could, but none of us were there trying to get sober because we were all teenagers and we were partying and we were doing what we were doing. Maybe there were some people that ended up getting sober out of that. I definitely wasn't one of them, because it wasn't what I was ready for. What was ironic about that trip to the treatment center was that, the director of the treatment center gave my mom this big book, which I thought I might still have here on the table. I must have put it away. She gave my mom this big book, and she said, "Your son isn't ready for this yet, but he's going to need it someday, so you should keep it. And when he needs it, you can give it to him." And so when I came into AA at 17, which I did not get sober that time, I bounced in and out for about 9 more months. I would go to a meeting every day, and my mom would give me $1 to put in the basket, but a pack of cigarettes was $1 back then. So I would take the dollar and I would buy a pack of cigarettes because there was Pickwick next door to where the meeting was. And so then they had a sign on the window that said that a case of Busch beer was on sale for $5. So I knew that if I got $5 for a big book, I could buy a case of beer, which seemed like a good bargain. And so I said, "I need $5 for a big book." And my mom said, no, "We've got one of those here." And she gave me this book, and I looked at it and I started reading it, and it was all about me. And I'm not a dumbass. I was smart. smarter than everybody else, obviously. So I knew at that point that this whole AA thing was a scam and that she had hired somebody to write this book to convince me that I was an alcoholic. And that's why the book just sounded so much like me and my life and the way that I drank. And even they went to the extreme of making up all the stories in the back of the book, which really, you know, like she must have paid somebody a lot of money to do that. And so I didn't get my $5 case of beer, which was disappointing, but eventually I did get sober, which is better off anyways. I wasn't ready to get sober back then when I started going to AA. I went to AA because the people around me thought I was ready to get sober. You know, they saw the wheels coming off and they knew that, you know, no good was going to come out of me continuing to do what I was doing. And I wasn't at the point where I could understand that I was an alcoholic. There's a line, you know, on page 30 in the big book, it says that we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This was the first step in the program of recovery, you know, and which is dramatically different than going to an AA meeting and raising your hand and saying, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I learned pretty fast that you can go to a meeting and you can say you're an alcoholic, then you can just say anything you want to say after that and everybody will just put up with you. But that fully concede to your innermost self thing, like that's really kind of where the rubber meets the road. And I wasn't at the point where I was able to do that. I didn't, where I got sober back in Clearwater, Florida, they used to say, put the word yet behind everything you hear in a meeting that hasn't happened to you and keep on drinking and it will. And so what happened was over the 9 months that I bounced in and out a lot, all those yets started coming true. You know, I didn't think that I was a blackout drinker, you know, and what would happen was I would go to meetings and 8 o'clock meeting. And then I'd get home after going to coffee with people after the meeting. And I'd look at the digital clock on the microwave and, you know, and it would just keep ticking away the minutes, you know, and it would always get to be just about 11 o'clock. And I would think to myself, well, you know, I'm not drinking because I went to an AA meeting. And I would think, well, I wonder what, you know, what my friends were up to. And, I mean, I knew what they were up to because they were up to the same thing every night, which was getting drunk. And, we would get loaded and drive around in cars because that's what you do when you're a teenager. And, but I would say to myself, I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to go see what they're doing. And I would go to see what they were doing. And shortly thereafter, and it was the same story every single time, you know, they would get me drinking before I would get them to stop drinking. And they weren't even trying to get me drinking. If anything, they would be like, aren't you going to AA? Doesn't that mean you don't drink? And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just going, you know, to get my mom happy. And even, you know, I had multiple jobs at restaurants and, cause I lived in a beach town and that's what you did. And I would go out, you know, with the people after work to the beach bar and cause that's where everybody went. And, you know, and I would tell the bartender, I'm going to have a Coke. And I'd say, cause I'm an alcoholic and I don't drink. And, you know, that would be night number one. You know, and then on night number two, I do the same thing. And then on night number three, I do the same thing. But this time I would go get the beer for the other people. And, you know, cause I was just, you know, being helpful. When you're an alcoholic, you like to be real helpful when it comes to liquor. And so then I would order a beer. And the bartender or the people I work with would say, I thought you don't drink because you're an alcoholic. And I'd say, no, that was last week. You know, I got all that under control now. And so it's okay. You know, nobody cared that you were 17. You were hanging out at a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning drinking liquor because that's just the way Florida was back then. But, you know, that should have been a big flashing, glaring red light. And if I was at all sane, it probably would have been. But I wasn't sane. I was insane as far as alcohol was concerned. You know, and that's the insanity around the first drink, that no matter how long I stayed away, and even for me, though, it wasn't a long period of time in the beginning, but no matter how long I stayed away from the first drink, you know, and I didn't have any sane thinking as far as anything else is concerned because I was a teenager, but the thought to drink would come and there would be no second thought that would come afterwards, or if it was exactly like the book describes, it was hazily and easily supplanted by the old threadbare idea that this time it would be different. That thought didn't usually come from me because I never needed it to be different. You know, I don't think I had ever gotten to the point where I needed to lie to myself about drinking. I just drank, and there was no, like, switch that ever said, don't drink, that's bad. And once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. It's the bottom line. It's the allergic reaction that they talk about in the doctor's opinion and in the beginning of the chapter, there is a solution. About halfway through that chapter is where they switch and start talking about the mental twist. But it was the allergic reaction that once I started, I kept going, and I never knew that I kept going because it was a physical compulsion to drink more. I didn't know that. And it took me that 9 months of being in and out of AA to figure that out. It was funny, you know, my dad was a big party guy. He wasn't a drinker at all, but, you know, he was in the music business. And so they, you know, his friends, they were all always having big parties. And one of his friends was having this keg party. And, you know, like a good alcoholic, I volunteered to man the keg and pour everybody beers. You know, so I would pour you a beer and me a beer, and one for you and one for me. And everybody that came up would get a beer, and I would get a beer. And my dad came up, and he said, you know, son, you got to learn to pace yourself. My dad did not understand alcoholism. And I looked at him, and I said, why? And I earnestly meant it, like, why would you want to pace yourself? That made no sense to me. So that was kind of how my drinking went from the minute I started drinking. It was never any different. My last big drunk, I had taken a job. I'd gotten sober again. I had taken a job working at a banquet facility. But it was the kind of place, it was like a restaurant, but for banquets. And so you would have your event there, and they'd have a couple of people working who would serve all the food and this, that, and the other. So me and this other guy were there working, and we were serving the food. And I went to get the drinks to bring in, and he had these pitchers of green stuff. And I said, what's that? And he said, oh, those are kamikazes. And I said, I've never heard of a kamikaze. And he says, you've never heard of a kamikaze? You got to have one. Now, I had just left an AA meeting. But, of course, when somebody says you ought to have one, you have one. And so there was no switch that said don't drink the kamikaze. What ended up happening was we served the people one pitcher of the kamikazes, and then we drank the rest of the kamikazes, and we left. And we left them there at the facility to serve themselves their food or whatever it was. And so when I went back, you know, a week or so later, because that's kind of how all my drunks went, the guy gave me my last paycheck and just shook his head. He was like, you're defective. I don't know what's wrong with you, but you're defective. And that was the beginning of recognizing that there was something wrong, you know, that, you know, like I couldn't even keep a job. I couldn't keep a job detailing cars. I couldn't keep a job bussing tables. I couldn't keep a job doing anything because I would drink or get high and it would throw the job down the toilet. So my last drunk started on July 3rd. I was back in AA for a couple more weeks after the kamikaze incident. And this friend of mine, his grandparents' house got broken into, and so his parents sent us down there to meet the police. And when we did the police report, we realized that whoever broke into the house didn't steal the liquor cabinet, which seems stupid. Like, if you're going to break into a house, you should steal the liquor cabinet. So we just figured, the cops said, if you find anything else missing, just write it down on this list. And so we wrote down liquor cabinet, and we stole the liquor cabinet. And that was July 3rd. And I got sober on July 10th. I kind of came to. I was walking through that neighborhood that I lived in. And I really don't know much other than that we drove to South Carolina to buy fireworks, and I did that in a blackout. And don't know much of anything that happened between July 4th and July 10th. And I just stayed drunk the whole time. I used to get drunk, and I had a car. When I finally got sober, I didn't have a car anymore. I had a bicycle with a flat tire. But I had a car, and I would get drunk, and I would leave the car places when I got drunk, like in the middle of an intersection at a red light, because it would just occur to me to go somewhere to do something, like get more liquor, and the car would stall, and I would leave it, and the police would tow it, and they'd call my mom. And it honestly, you know, Clearwater was a small town back then, but it had gotten to the point where when they called my mom, they'd tell her, we found your son's car again. And they would impound it. And then when I would come back and get sober, you know, a few days or a week later, whatever it was, we'd go get the car. And my mom was on a first name basis with the guy at the impound lot. And it was just, you know, it was just the way alcoholic drinking goes. What happened was that I came to on July 10th. I went to my cousin's house because I just really didn't know what else to do. And my cousin's mom's girlfriend was in AA, and she'd been sober about 20 years. And, you know, everybody was sitting around the table, and they were talking about what to do with Kenneth. And from the kitchen, she yelled, take him to an AA meeting. And so they put me in the car. They took me to an AA meeting. The meeting had just ended, so the people at the meeting took me to get coffee. And when you're new in AA, which we don't do this now with Zoom, obviously, but when we have meetings live, when you're new in AA and you go to coffee with the people, they always sit in a U-shaped booth at Denny's, and they put you in the middle of the U so you can't get out. And then they all sit around and they just talk to you. None of what anybody was saying made a lot of sense, but something clicked. And, you know, I hitchhiked home that night, and I didn't have really a home because I'd gotten thrown out of the house again for being drunk. And so I looked up in the sky. I was walking down this dark road in the middle of the night. I looked up in the sky. It was about 11, 12 o'clock. And I just said, God, I can't do this. I need help. And that for me was the moment of clarity, you know, and a sense of peace came over me at that point. And, you know, I have no understanding what God is or isn't. I can tell you that anybody that tells you they know what God is either locked up somewhere with a vest on, or they don't know what they're talking about. But, you know, I knew that the instant temptation to drink had been removed. And so I said, I'm willing to do anything. I need help. And the next day I bicycle tire, and I rode it to where this AA clubhouse was, and this guy who I didn't like said, are you coming back from a drunk? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. And he said, well, you do now. And I knew that he wasn't allowed to do that because, you know, nobody in AA is allowed to tell you anything. But I wasn't going to argue because I remembered that I said, I'm willing to do anything. Please help. And so he wrote on this piece of paper, he gave me a quarter, which is how much payphone cost back then. And he wrote on this phone number on a piece of paper, and on the back of the paper, he wrote, call before you drink. Which when I read that, I thought, wow, that's remarkable. Like, it had never occurred to me to call before I drank. I just waited until I got drunk, and then I stayed drunk, and then I came back. And so we parted ways after the meeting, and he asked me what I was doing, and I said, I don't know. And he said, you know, call me at 5 o'clock. So I called Norman at 5 o'clock, and he said, what are you doing tonight? I said, I don't know. And he said, go to a meeting and call me afterwards. And so I went to an 8 o'clock meeting and then I called Norman and he said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, call me when you wake up in the morning. So I called him when I woke up in the morning. He said, what are you doing today? And I said, I don't know. And he said, go to a meeting and then call me. And this went on for 5 days. Now, I had had other sponsors in AA. My first sponsor, they said, get somebody who has something you want. And this guy, Barry, had this big gold chain that I wanted. So I asked Barry to be my sponsor because I figured I would steal the chain. And I didn't know that it didn't work that way. And then the next guy that I had to be my sponsor was this guy named Nick. And Nick had a really hot sister who was in AA, and I wanted to go out with his sister. So I asked Nick to be my sponsor. You know, but Norman was the first one who said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And Norman was like really doing the whole AA thing. You know, like he kind of paced me along for the first few days. And then he said, what are you doing today? And I said, I don't know. And he said, be at my house at 5 o'clock. And he gave me his address. And I went to his house at 5 o'clock and I thought, now we're getting somewhere. Like this is, you know, like we're going to really find something out. And we sat down and started reading the big book. And you know, what Norman did that was different is I don't know if the other people I had asked to be my sponsor, you know, knew how AA worked, you know, whether they did or not. I wasn't ready to hear the solution, so it wouldn't have mattered what they did. But what Norman did was Norman just stuck with straight out of the book. Whatever the book said, that's what we did. And he opened the book to the forward of the first edition, and it says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. And he said, you've never followed the precise set of directions, and that's why AA doesn't work for you. And he said, you know, you can do it any way you want to do it, but if you want to stop drinking, you got to do what the other people that stopped drinking did. It's that simple. There's no magic bullet. You know, there's no secret, you know, handshake that nobody's telling you. You just haven't followed the directions. And he was right, you know, and it's like, you know, he had me dead to rights, you know, really. It's just he didn't have to use a lot of big words. He didn't have to, you know, elaborate on any information. You know, he didn't have any special skill set that made him like a super 12-stepper. He just came straight out of what the book said. And you know, later I learned that, and I do the same thing with the guys that I sponsor, you know, later I learned that the reason why Norman did that is because there was nothing Norman was going to do that was going to get me sober. You know, all Norman could do is exactly what the book says in either working with others or in A Vision for You, where it says we simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for their inspection. And that's what he did. You know, he just read what the book said and he said, either do it or Norman was famous back in Clearwater because whenever Norman would share, he would say, you can either work the steps or suffer, you bastard. And people used to hate that, but he was right. And so that's what he said to me, you know, and he's like, you know, I can't make you do it. You either want to do it or you don't want to do it. And, you know, and I wasn't kicking and screaming anymore. You know, I was somewhat willing, but I wasn't eager to do the work. So I did everything else I could possibly do other than work the steps. You know, and sure enough, if they said don't do something, then I did it. You know, in AA, they say don't get in a relationship in the first year. You know, well, tell an 18-year-old that. You know, that ain't going to happen. So, you know, there was this girl named Amy who was really cute. And so I thought Amy and I should probably get married because when you're 18, you really know what the fuck you're doing when it comes to relationship stuff. And so luckily Amy did not think we should get married. I'm sure she might not have stuck around long enough for us to get married, but that lasted for a couple of weeks, you know, and then, you know, I was time to get a job and I was going to go get a job at the beach and Norman said, what happens every time you get a job at the beach? And I said, you know, I don't know. And he said, well, you get drunk. And, you know, we have all these signs around the clubhouse where I got sober, you know, first things first, easy does it, this, that, and the other. And there was this one that said, think, think, think. And Norman said, that one does not apply to you. And, he said, why don't you bounce your thinking off of somebody that's been sober for a little while because their thinking might not be insane. And so, So that's what I decided to do. And so I said, I'm going to get a job. And Norman said, go ask Jimmy for a job. Jimmy's a surveyor. He probably needs a helper. Now, I did not like Jimmy, but I didn't like Norman, and that worked out okay. So I figured I'd go ask Jimmy for a job. So I go ask Jimmy for a job, and Jimmy, who I don't like, says, yep, I'll give you a job. And he says, I'll be by to your house to pick you up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I was like, 6 o'clock? You know, like I usually went to bed at 6 o'clock. So, you know, the idea of going to a job at 6 o'clock was not at all appealing, but they told me to do it, so I did it. Shortly thereafter, they fired Jimmy from the surveying company because Jimmy didn't get liked by a lot of people, apparently. But they kept me, and the owner of the surveying company said, I'll be there to pick you up at 6 in the morning. And so for 60 or 90 days, they came and picked me up every day at 6 o'clock in the morning and took me to work. And I didn't get drunk because I was working with a bunch of people that didn't drink, you know, which was weird. They didn't drink and they didn't smoke weed, you know, and they didn't get arrested and not show up for work the next day and all kinds of crazy stuff, you know. But that's, you know, like I started hanging out with a different group of people and then, you know, somehow I got the idea that I should buy a motorcycle. So I went to the motorcycle dealership and the guy at the motorcycle dealership, they wouldn't just apparently give you financing for a motorcycle. Like you had to have some money or something. But there was this other guy there that they were just giving the motorcycle to. And I said, well, why is he getting a motorcycle? And he said, cause he's in the military. And if you're in the military, you get financing. So obviously it made sense for me to join the military so I could get a motorcycle. And I didn't tell my sponsor this at first because I knew he'd probably say no. But eventually I told him and he said, why don't you wait a year? So I went and I saw the recruiter and I waited until 6 more months till I had a year. Then I had already signed up. So then I went and joined the military. I didn't know that you had to go to boot camp and all that other stuff before you get a motorcycle. I didn't know that they weren't just going to put you where you wanted to be on the beach somewhere so you could have the motorcycle, you know. So it was like there was a lot of things I didn't know about joining the military. But I joined the Coast Guard and went through boot camp, got stationed out in Washington, spent 4 years out west in Oregon and Washington, came real close to getting drunk, but I didn't. Because even though I, you know, was in the Coast Guard, so, you know, so I did get the motorcycle and then I got the girlfriend and if you have a girlfriend and she's pretty enough, you don't have to go to AA meetings. So I wasn't going to AA meetings and I had the motorcycle and everything was going great. Then the thought to drink came. And when the thought to drink came, the only thing I remember that saved my ass was back home, they always said, if you think about drinking, pray before you do. They used to say, put the white chip in your mouth. If it melts, then you can take a drink, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the thing they said about pray before you drink, like somehow I remember that. And so I walked up the beach from where my friends were and I prayed for a minute and said, if it's a good idea for me to drink, let me drink. By the time I walked back to where they were, they had put the fire out and they were leaving because they ran out of beer. And that was like a big flashing red flag for me. The next day I took off at noon. I took a long lunch break and I went to an AA meeting. That was at 2.5 years sobriety. And I've never left AA since. I learned my lesson, thankfully, you know, by the grace of God. So, you know, I got right back involved in the program and I got a sponsor there in Portland and was, you know, going to meetings every day and doing everything that we're supposed to be doing because the idea that the thought to drink came back, it terrified me. You know, it really like struck a chord inside. And, you know, that was in Portland. I was in Portland, Oregon at the time. And this lady at the Northwest Alano Club where I've been going to meetings, this lady had gone to Hawaii on vacation. She had 20 years of sobriety and she'd gone, you know, to meetings, done everything. She went to Hawaii for 14 days and she got drunk. And it just shocked me, you know, that at 20 years of sobriety that you could drink again. And I think that's when it really hit me more than ever before, that alcoholism is a disease and it doesn't ever go away. And you can be doing everything and stop doing it. And if the thought to drink comes at the wrong time, you're going to drink. It's not that we live in fear of drinking, but we don't have an effective mental defense against the first drink. And so, you know, I got back busy working the steps. I had started working the steps over again several times, but I got a little relief after I got to the third column of the fourth step. So I didn't have to do the rest of it. And, I would just tear it up and throw it away. And so, you know, at that point I got busy back working the steps a little bit and working with other alcoholics. And, you know, I was still young, so I was crazy and doing all kinds of crazy stuff and, you know, traveling, and I was in the military, Coast Guard, so I had a lot of money and, you know, for back then a lot of money, you know, and I had cars and motorcycles and, you know, we traveled and did all kinds of fun, crazy stuff. I was racing motorcycles, you know, just everything crazy you can think about doing, I was doing. And it was great because I was sober. And so I had like a sense of freedom. And it's funny because I'm still friends with a lot of people that I was friends with back then, people that I was in the Coast Guard with, you know, and they all say the same thing. They're like, you had a sense of freedom about you that nobody else had. And that was because of AA, you know, because AA gave me that freedom. You know, I had nothing to fear. And it was a great way to grow up, and, you know, which is what I did. And so I got out of the service. I went back to Florida for a year. Then I moved up here to Georgia to go to school and ended up in Atlanta going to school at Georgia State and stayed sober. And, you know, and then, you know, which actually seems to be a little trend for me back then, got a very pretty girlfriend, so I didn't really need as much AA anymore. But I was going to meetings, but I didn't get a sponsor. My old sponsor said, you need to get a sponsor down there in Atlanta. And I was like, nah, I'll keep you because you're far enough away that I can do whatever I want and get away with it. And so, you know, I got this guy. I was about 8 years sober. The pretty girl left. And I went to a men's meeting at the Triangle Club, and I like barfed up some crazy emotional bullshit all over all these poor people. And this guy said, you should probably get a sponsor. And he said, you should talk to my sponsor. He's a good sponsor. And this guy's name was OK. I did not like the name OK, which was kind of like, to me, that was obvious that I needed him as a sponsor, because so far everybody that I've worked with that I didn't like, it worked out just great. So this guy OK and I went to coffee, and it was funny because later when I picked up my 20-year chip, AA OK gave me my 20-year chip, and he said, you know, I was in this men's meeting and there's this kid sharing and he's crazy, and I'm praying and I'm saying, God, please don't let him ask me. Please don't let him ask me. But sure enough, it worked out. So we go to coffee, and OK says, you know, it sounds like it's time to write an inventory. And so I thought, no, probably not. So I fired OK and called my old sponsor, Dave, back. And Dave said, you know, you need to call the inventory guy back. So I called OK back, and we started working together, but I still wasn't ready to write an inventory. Then we went to coffee, and OK says, you know, I have a big shoe. And I was like, I don't know what you mean by that. And he says, well, you don't want it up your ass, so you better get busy writing your inventory, or I'm going to kick you in the ass. So I had had enough pain at that point that even though I knew I didn't need to do it, I went and wrote the inventory. So at 8.5 years sober, I wrote 52 pages of resentments, which was amazing when you think about it. But a lot of stuff had built up over those 8 years since the first thorough inventory I had done. And so we went over my inventory, you know, and a miraculous thing happened, you know, that I got reconnected with sobriety. I'd always stayed connected with AA since the Portland almost drinking incident, excuse me. But I reconnected with AA in a different way, and I started to grow spiritually, you know, and I learned. I was worked with OK up until his death at about 19 years, and I learned so much from him. You know, one day I was probably 12 years, 15 years sober at the time. And, you know, we were at lunch. We used to get together once a week and sit down, have face-to-face. Okay, always said, if you're thinking about it, you should be talking about it. And he said that we should always have at least one person that knows everything about us, that we have an honest face-to-face conversation with on a regular basis, so they always know what's going on with us. So we were sitting and talking. I'd been dating this girl that worked at the Cheetah for a while, and I was having a little trouble with her. The trouble was she wasn't doing what I wanted her to be doing, which I hadn't gotten sober enough to give up trying to get people to do what I wanted them to be doing. And so I was explaining the problem with Christine to OK, and he was just looking at me, nodding. And it occurred to me, like, you know, this guy's old. He doesn't know what it's like to date a stripper. He doesn't work in nightclubs like I do. He doesn't know the problems that I have, you know. And then, you know, these thoughts are kind of rolling through my brain. And I thought, and look at him. He's happy all the time. He's not self-centered like I am because he's old. And all he ever does is do 12-step work. He works, he sponsors like 35 guys. All he does is work with other alcoholics all the time. And that was one of those light bulb moments. I realized that it wasn't that he didn't suffer or struggle with the same stuff I struggled with. It was that he was getting out of self-centeredness by doing work with other alcoholics. And so he didn't have time to be consumed by self, you know, which is what I was suffering from. And that launched me on a new course in sobriety where I got busy doing work with other alcoholics, you know, and a couple of years later, you know, I was in a meeting and somebody was, I've been going to this one meeting on a regular basis, and I was really getting annoyed by how much people were sharing about stuff that had nothing to do with AA at these meetings. I didn't, for some, probably because I'm full of shit, I didn't just stop going to the meeting. You know, I just wanted to go and be pissed off about it. And so I was talking to OK about it, and he said, well, how many big book studies are you leading? And I said, well, none. But that's not the problem. The problem is these other people. And he says, well, it sounds like you need to start leading big book studies so that you can help people understand what the big book has to say. And so OK and I sat down and went through the big book, and we kind of picked out, you know, we picked out the stuff that was really about how to get through work in the 12 steps as quickly as possible. Not because the other stuff in the big book isn't important. It's tremendously important. Read the book. Don't skip a word. All that stuff. But, you know, what had kind of like occurred to me was that there was a lot of people in AA that weren't working the steps because they didn't know the directions for working the steps. And I didn't know the directions for working the steps until people had taken the time to share them with me. And you know, the way that OK worked the steps was really, you know, a lot based in the Joe and Charlie method, because he had gotten sober with Joe and Charlie back then. And so we put together this format for a big book study. And so I started leading these big book studies, you know, and then, like, it turned out that I kind of had a knack for leading big book studies. And so this small group of people and I were leading big book studies, and somebody came up with the idea that, you know, you should make that a CD. And so we made it a CD, and now it's on the internet. It's free because nobody uses CDs anymore. My computer doesn't even use CDs, you know, but, you know, we produced all these CDs, and I started going all over the place doing big book studies. And I had this awakening. I was at the Atlanta Roundup, and I think it was Clancy or somebody was telling his story, and I was looking at how worn out he was. And he said something, and about how much time he spends traveling telling his story. And I thought, I need to nip this in the butt, because the last thing I want to do is be traveling 3 weeks a month leading big book studies places. So I had a talk with God about it, and I said, now I'm willing to do whatever you want me to do, but please don't want me to be traveling all over the place leading big book studies. And so, you know, whether for better or for worse, I kind of scaled back the big book study thing just a little bit. And luckily nobody ever asked me to come become a Svorkut speaker, which would just be miserable. So I'm grateful for that. But, you know, I was leading big book studies in a lot of places and sponsoring several guys, and things were going really good. And, as good as could be, you know, and, you know, that period of, you know, 5 years or whatever turned into 10 years or whatever. And, you know, now it's I'm sober 34 years, 35 years this summer. And, you know, and I just keep not drinking. I keep finding ways. When the pandemic thing happened, I thought, you know, I was sitting around the house, and first of all, I was completely opposed to Zoom. Because I was like, I'm as, you know, computer savvy as a 50-year-old needs to be, but I was like not going to AA meetings on the computer, because that was some, like, you know, crap young people needed to be doing. And so I was completely opposed to Zoom. So then I started doing Zoom meetings begrudgingly, and turned out that I loved Zoom meetings, you know. And then, you know, we stopped having the groups that I was going to, stopped having in-person meetings. So I helped a couple of those groups take those meetings online via Zoom, you know, and we went from having 5 or 6 people at a meeting to having like 40 or 50 people at a meeting, you know, and that's been great. And I've expanded, you know, what I do a little bit with the Zoom stuff, you know, because I had another little moment where I said, you know, it's all well and good that you're sober and you're hanging out at your house and you're happy, but you need to be carrying the AA message to more people. And, you've got to come up with ways to do that. And the way to do that now is online. So I sponsor some guys, you know, through Zoom, and we get together, and, you know, and I help a couple of meetings that I'm involved with do their Zoom meetings. And, you know, and when somebody says, will you come speak at our Zoom meeting? I say yes, even though I don't like to, just because, you know, I just don't get all that jazzed up about it. I was at this meeting and they said, we need volunteers for some mini convention that we're having, you know. And my first thought is, well, you know, I'm 34 years sober and I speak at many conventions. So, you know, I'll be happy to speak for you. And they asked me, well, would you mind, you know, being a greeter? And I was like, yeah, I'm happy to do that. You know, it was great. It was exactly what I needed to do. And it turned out that the lady that spoke was from my hometown. And even though, you know, she had moved after I'd left, it was hearing her share about all this stuff from back there where I got sober was just fantastic. You know, and I had the greatest time doing it. And, you know, I think that, you know, the biggest thing for me of late is in, and really through Zoom and the pandemic and all that stuff, you know, is being another Bob on the bus, you know, is that I'm just here. I'm going along for the ride. I'm doing the best I can do on a daily basis. I don't have to stand out wherever I go. I've learned something about Zoom meetings is I love listening to so many people from all over the world. You know, it's just fantastic. And you just get to hear people share. And some of the meetings that I go to, you know, I listen and there'll be 100 people in the meeting, 200 people, and, you know, like 70% of the people are just getting sober. And I think what a phenomenal thing that we've got now with AA, that we can carry the message of AA to that many people who might not normally go to a meeting. You know, because they're not going to get in their car and go and be seen by people and all that stuff. And it's just, you know, like at every twist of the road, you know, there's another silver lining to the cloud that's coming. So, maybe we're making a better time of it than a lot of people are through Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, I'm grateful for that if that's the case. And with that, I'll shut up, and I'll post the link in the chat for that big book study just in case anybody wants to listen to it. And thanks for having me.
Great job, Ken. Thanks, Ken. It's great.
Thank you, Ken, and thanks for offering to post that link. I was going to ask you to do that.
Yep.
We're going to unmute everybody and have a little round table with you.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks. Did not disappoint. We knew it was going to be great.
Yep.
Funny, too.
Yep.
I'm always amazed at
Yeah, it's the first time I've heard your story, but I knew that you had stopped, you know, that you had started AA really young. And I'm just amazed at that. I don't know if you look back on that and see how amazing that is, because to get sober at that age is like, how many people do that, you know?
I look at it and think about how lucky I am. You know, what's funny is the way I got sober was that people drug me. You know, I didn't go, you know, like I didn't even know that I was a part of the first Florida Convention of Young People in AA, because the people I was hanging out with in AA were in the young people's movement. And so they brought me along to the meetings and all this different stuff. You know, that's just how AA works. If you're willing to go, they'll bring you.
Yeah. Yeah, and the service work you do is incredible, Ken.
I think it's a great story, and that everybody you didn't like ended up being the exact one that would help you, yep. Or okay, or just planned your path right there. Great, great share.
I really enjoyed it, Ken. I was having some computer problems as I've been. I love you're just so real and natural, and the motorcycle story and the bicycle, which just happened to have a flat tire. You tell it in such a wonderful way, and there's a lot of enthusiasm, even if you said you weren't getting all hyped up about it. There's still a lot of enthusiasm and fun. And I think that's a message that I can't get enough of that. Thank you so very much. I appreciate you.
Thank you. I always love seeing you at meetings.
Thank you so much, Ken. You know, you really could, as you shared your story, your humility, just how humble you are along the way and how you weren't that way to begin with. You know, I mean, you still have your funny personality, but you got it, you know, you get it. And that's what, you know, it was a good reminder to me as well, too. Don't complain about others. You know, be part of the solution instead of the problem.
Thank you.
I'm Anna Doris. I'm an alcoholic. You know, at first I looked at this, but your thing and with the skull and all that, I thought, oh my gosh, what is this going to be like? and then you start, I've been on a lot of meetings today, and I thought, okay, I'm just going to sit this one out. I'm going to do my bicycle ride and just listen. And so I took my glasses off, and all of a sudden I heard you talking, and I had to put my glasses back on, stop the bicycle and say, and I started burst out laughing about, you know, basically how, you know, everything that wasn't good for you, you just were told to do it. You were defiant about it, and then the guy okay, and then you decided, and your sponsor said whatever. It was very, very funny, and I appreciate it, and got me inspired, because I love Zoom meetings now too. At first, I didn't think they were going to be so great, but as Isla said in the other meeting the other day, it's very intimate, and so thank you very much for coming to share your experience, strength, and hope.
Thank you. And that flag for the people who, because they're going to listen to this but not see it, that's the Tampa Bay Buccaneers flag, who are the World Super Bowl champions, which is as close as Atlanta has ever come to winning a Super Bowl, is 400 miles away. So that's why I have that up there. It's very exciting. You know, and it's funny about the not liking people and then it being good for me. I put a link in there for a tradition study that Paul McKee and I, who many people know, we lead, or we used to lead, we don't do it anymore, but we used to lead this 12 tradition study, and so we did a recording of that also. And at first I didn't like Paul, because Paul was really humble, and Paul was just, you know, like so sweet, and I thought there's something weird about all that. And then Paul and I turned out to be dear friends, and we go leading tradition studies, and Paul knows more about AA than just about anybody I think I've ever met. So.
Amen.
Yeah, I'm Patty, an alcoholic still, and Ken, I just, You came in so early, and I think I met you in probably 93, and you were still such a kid, but you were flying with AA, and I remember OK and loved him, and a hell of a guy, so such a cool cat. And but you have done so much work for the Bridge Builders on the weekends, our Zoom meeting, and Ken was the guy who said, you know, we're really not practicing the fifth tradition with the 10 of us who have a bunch of time on this meeting. And he helped us open it up to the world, basically. And we have people from all over the world and all over the country. And I'm really grateful to you for that. So thanks.
Very good work.
Upside down, falling off the edge. Just don't sound like fun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. Ought to learn a lesson, breaking all the rules. Try a listening session. The guilty loves it too. Sleep away the day, hiding from the sun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. Fighting.